I'm Vermont Edition producer Sam Gale Rosen. This podcast has been edited for clarity and brevity. Thanks for listening.
This is Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. Three high-profile murder or attempted murder cases were recently dismissed by Chittenden County State's Attorney Sarah George. Announcing the dismissals altogether, George said that in each case, the state did not have enough evidence to rebut the legal insanity claims the defendants were expected to make at trial. She wrote in a statement, "Our review of the evidence indicates that defendants have substantial admissible evidence to prove to a jury by a preponderance of the evidence that they were insane at the time the crimes were committed." There was significant pushback and some alarm caused by this announcement. Even the governor has weighed in. In a few minutes, we're going to go deeper into how the assessment of legal insanity is made and what happens to people after their charges have been dismissed. But let's first get a better sense of the cases and the timeline. Liam Elder Connors is a reporter for VPR who's been covering the cases, and he joins us now. Hi, Liam.
Hi, Jane.
So can you briefly, and you know, without salacious detail, but enough so that we know what the cases are that we're talking about, describe each of these three cases?
Sure. So the first case is Veronica Lewis, who in 2015 was accused of attempted murder for shooting her firearms instructor. And then there were two cases from
And her firearms instructor survived.
Yes, so he did survive. Yes, so that's attempted murder. So the other two cases are the murder cases, and both of those occurred in 2017 in Burlington. And so Lewis Fourier is allegedly stabbed a man to death in downtown Burlington during the middle of the day, a pretty terrible crime there. And then Aida Garung in 2017 was accused of killing his wife with a meat cleaver and trying to kill his mother-in-law. So these are all pretty high-profile cases and all pretty terrible ones as well.
That third case that you mentioned was also in the middle of the day in front of many witnesses as well.
Yes.
So I mentioned that State's Attorney Sarah George said the state would not be able to rebut claims of legal insanity from each of these defendants. What else did she say? What was her reasoning?
Well, the state, you know, not having enough evidence, they brought in experts to interview these people to try to determine if they could make a case that they were not legally insane at the time. And so essentially what she's saying is, you know, all the experts that have talked to these individuals, including the experts that the prosecution brought in, were not able to come to the conclusion that they were not insane. So saying that she doesn't have the evidence is that, you know, the state can't prove in court that they weren't insane. So that's sort of the big issue there that she's talking about.
Has she mentioned why she filed these dismissals altogether? Because I think all three at once also had sort of the impact of elevating these three, you know, and sort of looking like a pattern and, you know, potentially making people feel like, what is happening here? Because all three of these cases were dismissed at the same time.
Mm-hmm. Well, one of the things that also has come up with that is that they occurred right after a case that the state won against Stephen Burgoyne. And in that, they were debating the question of whether or not he was insane at the time. And in that case, the state proved that he was not insane at the time. And Stephen Burgoyne was accused of killing five teenagers in a wrong-way driving accident. And so,
this was also prosecuted by Chittenden County State's Attorney's
also
Office.
Also prosecuted by Sarah George. And so the difference in that case is that the state had experts who were able to testify saying that Burgoyne was not insane at the time. And so one of the reasons was Sarah George was waiting, she said, until after that trial to release the rulings on these cases, so not to influence the jury or the decision in that case. So that's one of the reasons why all three of those came out together and also after that.
So there may have been sort of a bottleneck waiting for the end of the Burgoyne case.
Exactly, not wanting to alter public perception or taint the jury pool.
What's the reaction been to Sarah George's announcement?
Well, people have been, you know, as you said, reacted with alarm, including Governor Phil Scott, who shortly after the decision sent a letter to Attorney General T.J. Donovan asking Donovan to review and possibly refile charges in these cases, which is a pretty unusual thing. It's not something that we'd expect to see because state's attorneys are independently elected prosecutors, and you're having the attorney general come in and sort of potentially question the decisions that these prosecutors are making. So that's not something that we see too often here in the state. And it's also interesting because T.J. Donovan used to be the Chittenden County State's Attorney. And so he's also, you know, made unpopular decisions and dismissed cases. And so it set up this kind of interesting dynamic of asking the attorney general to look at these cases again.
Well, and in his response, the attorney general, T.J. Donovan, pointed out to the governor. And again, you know, these are public letters, so it's unclear whether he's trying to point it out to the governor or pointing out to all of Vermont. You know, I don't really have jurisdiction over Sarah George's cases, and this is a highly unusual thing. Nonetheless, he is going to look into them?
Yes. He has said, and he sent a letter to the governor kind of officially making this public and clear. He is going to take a look at these cases. He's going to review them. He's not going to commit to refiling any charges, but he says he'll certainly take a look. And for what it's worth, when I spoke to Sarah George about this, she says, you know, the attorney general is welcome to review these cases and will cooperate with that review as well.
What has she said in reaction to the governor's unhappiness with her decision?
She's had a pretty strong response, you know, in interviews and, you know, on Twitter. She came out pretty strongly criticizing the governor for this letter. When I spoke to her, she called the letter insulting and kind of not only was questioning her judgment, but the judgment of all the attorneys and law enforcement that worked on this case. She said the governor could have picked up the phone and given her a call, could have reached out to her. She said the governor did not reach out to ask her about the decision-making process in that case. And she said that she felt like it was a more of a political stunt and not something that was truly in the interest of public safety, like the governor said.
Is she responding to other criticism about these dismissals?
You know, I think a lot of what the governor brought up are the things people have been criticizing her for, that, you know, it's kind of – we don't know when these individuals who are in the care of the Department of Mental Health will eventually be released from custody that they're in the facilities they're staying at. So people have criticized her for the public safety aspect primarily.
To which she and others have replied that that's not actually her jurisdiction. What happens to people who have had charges dismissed or who may not have been found guilty, she doesn't have any control over that.
Right. That's another system. So and she's saying, you know, this is something we need to be talking about and figuring out, you know, how do we kind of balance between ensuring public safety and ensuring these individuals who need mental health care get mental health. And so it's a complex topic and one worth looking into more.
We're going to do that in a couple of minutes because we're going to talk more about what an actual definition of legal insanity is, what happens then to people whose cases are dismissed generally, and, you know, all of the sort of nuances of this kind of conversation. And listeners, if you have a question about that, you can get your questions ready by getting on the phone now. You can call 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211. Or post your questions on the Vermont Edition page at vpr.org. I'm speaking with VPR's Liam Elder Connors, who's looked into this issue and into these cases. We mentioned that the Attorney General, T.J. Donovan, has said he will look at these three cases and will consider refiling. In the meantime, federal prosecutors are bringing charges against one of the defendants, Victoria Lewis. She's the one who is accused of shooting her firearms instructor who survived.
Right. And so that was last week. The federal prosecutors announced they would seek charges. And the charges aren't related actually to attempted murder at all. They're to do with other aspects of that case. And those are they're charging her with unlawfully possessing a stolen firearm because she took the firearm from the instructor, and possessing a firearm after being found mentally defective. And that has to do with a 2013 court ruling that Lewis was involved in Queens. So that's like another separate issue. So the feds are looking at those charges and bringing them against Veronica Lewis in this.
And Liam, you mentioned this a little bit and talking about a different system that certainly deals with mental health and with people who may be a threat to themselves or others. But what does happen now to these three defendants now that charges have been dismissed?
Well, you know, it's a little unclear. We don't have any specifics on that. The Department of Mental Health won't comment on individual cases. But what we do know is that generally when people reach a certain threshold, once, you know, they've received care and are deemed no longer a danger to themselves or others, they will be released. That doesn't mean the Department of Mental Health is not going to necessarily keep tabs on them or watch over them in some way, but they won't be held in a secure facility at some point. So these individuals will eventually get out once they've been treated to the extent that the Department of Mental Health feels they're ready to be released.
Once and if, presumably. I mean, it's not a guarantee, is it?
It's not a guarantee, but, you know, generally people at some point complete these courses of treatment. But again, it's unclear because they can't really talk about individual cases.
Liam Elder-Connors is a reporter for VPR. Liam, thanks very much for talking with us.
You bet.
After three high-profile cases were dismissed in Chittenden County over planned insanity defenses, we are talking about the legal and health issues behind these questions of what is legal insanity, why would charges be dismissed, what does it actually mean to be legally insane, how is it determined, and how does it affect court cases. Thomas Powell is a forensic psychologist and founding partner of Vermont Forensic Assessment. He was also director of clinical services for the Vermont Department of Corrections for 18 years. Welcome back. Thanks for being on the show today, Thomas.
Thank you.
And Dr. Simcha Rabin is the interim chief medical officer at the Brattleboro Retreat. She's a forensic psychiatrist and serves on the faculty at the Yale School of Medicine Division of Law and Psychiatry. I'll also note that the Brattleboro Retreat is a VPR underwriter. Dr. Rabin, thanks for being on the program today.
Thanks for having me.
Dr. Rabin, what does it mean to be legally insane?
So to be legally insane means that an individual has been found by the court to not be able to appreciate essentially the wrongfulness or criminality of a particular action, or it's been found that they could not conform or control their behavior at a particular instance related to a particular act.
And a definition of legal insanity has to be tied in that case to a specific event. I mean, this is a legal definition used in trials. It's different from a medical condition that you may have been found to have.
That's correct. It's tied not only to a specific event, but to someone's ability to understand their wrongfulness and to control their actions. And that if they have impairment in those abilities, those impairments must be due to a mental illness, not intoxication.
Thomas Powell, can you just remind us of the difference between the definition of legal insanity at the time a crime is committed or alleged to have been committed, how that's different from a determination of whether or not someone is competent to stand trial?
Competency refers to an individual's present state of mind and ability to function within the justice system such that they can advise and work with their attorney in their own defense. They can understand the charges that are brought against them. They can understand concepts such as a plea agreement or a guilty plea. And they understand the role of the court officers. In contrast to that, the insanity plea focuses on an individual's state of mind at the time of the alleged act. And it may be years before. It's not a current issue. It's a past issue at the time. And these are separate concepts with separate adjudicative elements that go with them.
So you could be found to be not competent to stand trial but not legally insane at the time of the crime, or vice versa, or both.
That is correct.
And how do you determine whether someone was legally insane at the time they may have committed a crime?
Well, this requires evaluations by competent professionals who understand what the stakes are and what the requirements and criteria are. It generally will involve a psychiatrist or a psychologist or both examining and assessing an individual, referring back to their state of mind at the time, and looking at whether or not they had a mental illness of sufficient magnitude, severity, and intensity that it meets criteria under either state or federal statutes, which are not the same. And also that because of that, they are unable to appreciate what they're doing is wrong and or conform their behavior to the requirements of the law. So what they are doing is essentially inferring what an individual's state of mind was back when the offense occurred. And sometimes that's straightforward because the mental illness is profound and unchanging. Other times, not so much.
So can you describe a little bit more specifically? I mean, obviously not using any one specific case by name, but give me a sense of, you know, what kind of questions would you as a forensic psychologist ask somebody if you were doing that kind of assessment?
Well, I'd certainly want to, prior to interviewing them, review the records because that is oftentimes a window into their past that you don't have access to easily. And you're looking for contradictions and aspects of their presentation which may or may not be consistent. We certainly want to know what their understanding was of what was going on at the time. There's a number of protocols we can follow that include structured interviewing, open interviewing, and psychological testing. Of course, for a psychologist, one of the things we're very interested in is whether the individual may be malingering mental illness. And that is to say, essentially faking it for secondary gain, which is to be found innocent.
Which I think a lot of people would wonder, you know, if that's happening in many cases.
And with good reason. It sometimes does. And other times you have a track record which holds up over a number of years, which paints a very consistent picture of severe mental disturbance. And because of that, this person stumbled into a set of behaviors and acts which resulted in a horrible outcome. You know, it's interesting that often we will be asked to examine these folks, and the severity of the alleged act does matter in terms of how quickly a person may be referred out of the justice system, so that if you have a relatively minor shoplifting case, for instance, you know, the system is pretty good at quickly removing them from the justice end of things. But in a case like these three that were dismissed, those are horrible outcomes with terrible consequences for the victims and their families. So it's a much more cautious procedure.
Dr. Ravin, what can you add about this process and how someone is assessed to be determined whether they were legally insane at the time of a crime? Because and maybe what the difference is between what a forensic psychologist might do in this situation and what you might do as a forensic psychiatrist.
Oh, sure. As Dr. Powell notes, it's a pretty methodical, careful assessment that starts with review of health records in a young person, potentially educational records, interviews with the individual, with their family members, and often several interviews focusing on their recollection of their state of mind and the events that are in question. One of the things that I often consider is if there are organic factors or factors related to medical illness that may affect an individual and their thought process and their state of mind at the time of an offense.
How often do you find that someone who is being considered for an insanity defense when these kinds of officials like you and like Thomas Powell might be called in, how often is that actually the case, that someone was either legally insane or was exhibiting symptoms of a severe enough mental illness that they would not have been, you know, they would not have had control over themselves at that time?
I'd say in the majority of the cases that I've been asked to evaluate, they've been already carefully considered, and many of the people who really weren't suffering from a significant mental illness or had impairment that was transitory or due to substance intoxication, they've already been weeded out. So the majority I've found I was able to support an insanity defense for them.
Again, today we're talking about what the definition of legal insanity is, what it actually means then in terms of the treatment someone might get. We're going to talk a little bit more about that. And just answering questions that many of you may have about what is happening in these kinds of situations. Elizabeth is calling in from Moortown. Hi, Elizabeth.
Hello.
Hi.
Hi.
Go right ahead.
My question is, what is the state doing to support the rehabilitation and development of mental health? What kind of housing and support systems are being offered for people who are found insane or just suffering from mental health?
So, Elizabeth, do you mean separate from the criminal justice system or specifically people who have been accused of heinous crimes but who may be found to have been insane at that time?
I kind of both. In the criminal justice system, for me, I sat through a 3-week hearing where a man said after a year and a half of after being charged with the murder of my child and four of her friends, he decided to claim temporary insanity at the time of the incident.
Elizabeth, your daughter was killed by Stephen Burgoyne, right?
Yes, my daughter Mary was killed by Stephen Burgoyne.
And so you want to see more efforts at rehabilitation, more more help in dealing with mental health? Is that what you're looking for?
Yes. I guess I'm more concerned about two things. Stephen Burgoyne, after a year and a half, was able to claim temporary insanity, which cost our government tons of money and resources. While I sat there and looked at a man for 3 weeks, or actually 2.5 years, because I went to hearings regarding his sanity and insanity. And it seemed the whole time he had no feeling. He was just sort of filled with, I don't know, he just didn't seem insane.
Mm.
And then, I'm sorry, the second part of the question, or that my question is, that was the state using up time and resources for a man who wasn't insane, where Sarah George felt and her team felt that they had enough evidence to prove that he wasn't insane. And right now we have 3 cases of people that Sarah George has found these people to be insane, and there's not enough proof to prove that they weren't insane.
Yeah.
And with these people that now their cases have been dropped and they've been found insane, where will they go and who will help them? Vermont doesn't have very many facilities, really any facilities, to help house and rehabilitate people who have been insane, charged of heinous crimes.
Elizabeth, I let's take it from there. And I thank you for calling in and, you know, join everyone else in saying how sorry we are about what happened to your daughter and the death of your daughter. But also, I'm pleased to hear you questioning these, because these are the questions that we want to ask in the show. So I appreciate that. And Dr. Ravin, let me put that to you. You know, what about, I mean, there's a lot to unpack there, and we're going to spend the next 20 minutes talking about many of those things. But yeah, what is there in the state for somebody who was declared legally insane or would have withstood a trial and been found to be legally insane to actually have rehabilitation?
So I want to thank Elizabeth for that enormously important question. Right now, someone who has been found insane, somebody who's an insanity acquittee in Vermont, will receive treatment in a psychiatric hospital or psychiatric unit, and be treated clinically, not unlike anyone else seeking psychiatric treatment in an inpatient context. And we have very limited infrastructure and programs for insanity acquittees or people who've been found legally insane. And I think that creates a big gap, both for those individuals' ongoing treatment as their transition to the community, and for effective monitoring in the community that protects both the individual and the community.
Does there need to be more? I mean, is it a state resource problem?
I think it is a state resource problem. And I'd like to contrast it to some of the structures that other states have so that we can see what's possible. And there are some really exciting possibilities that are robust structures to monitor and treat insanity acquittees. Just south of us in Connecticut, they have a system called the Psychiatric Security Review Board, or PSRB. And this is a board that monitors all insanity acquittees in the state. So as soon as anyone is found to have a successful insanity defense, they are monitored by this board that's composed of people from different disciplines, lawyers, clinicians, a victim's advocate, people from corrections. And this body governs both their treatment while they're being treated in an inpatient facility and their movement through that facility and into the community. And they're regularly and closely monitored. And I think that there's an opportunity in Vermont to build this sort of structure, and it would serve both people with with mental illness and criminal justice involvement and protect our communities.
Thomas Powell, can I just get some clarity on the legal definition here when we're talking about someone who has been found to be legally insane? In the cases that we're discussing, the three dismissals of cases, Sarah George said in her dismissals that the state would not be able to rebut a defense of legal insanity, but the cases were dismissed without prejudice. So for these three individuals, have they been found to be legally insane if their cases were dismissed? Is there any difference in how they now move through the system if they have had all of their charges legally dismissed?
No. There's not a finding of not guilty by reason of insanity in the absence of a trial where that is the verdict.
Right.
So what you do have is a suspension of the criminal justice process via the state's attorney's decision to turf the case over to the Commissioner of Mental Health for further treatment and custody. So it's a different thing. If Burgoyne had been successful in his defense, he would have found himself perhaps still in custody in some way, but having been found not guilty by reason of insanity, he would be off the hook as far as the criminal charges went. I frankly think that the Burgoyne case, in contrast to the three dismissals, demonstrates a pretty high ethical standard by the state's attorney of Chittenden County, Sarah George. I think she did a very good job of prosecuting with Susan Hardin the case against Burgoyne. It was a tough case against an excellent attorney. And with a relatively low standard of evidence in Vermont, which is simply a preponderance of evidence. 51% is all that the defense needs to show that the likelihood was greater than not that he was insane at the time. And she won that case. In contrast, I think she felt that it was not serving the interests of justice to pursue three cases where she thought she couldn't win. We know that she'll try a case when she thinks she can win, because she did. But in cases like the other three, she found that there was sufficient evidence that it was more likely than not that they would not be found guilty. So that's a very significant, I think, symbol of a system that is being thoughtful about these things. Now, I would agree that Vermont lacks a system of care that allows forensic patients and corrections inmates to have some sort of continuity of intervention and custody and treatment. And the type of program that Connecticut uses would be great in Vermont. Vermont's a small state, so we oftentimes cut corners on these things. But I would hope that the governor is able to see that that's a resource need and some policy leadership that's really needed as a result of this controversy we now have. And that the legislature would step up to the plate, allocate money, and make this happen in a way that just doesn't happen now. And I know from firsthand experience as the former clinical director in corrections that we were constantly cobbling together case plans with the Department of Mental Health as best we could in corrections and having huge holes in the system because they just the resources weren't there.
We're getting many comments from people who have pretty strong feelings about this. Tom Dalton, executive director of Vermonters for Criminal Justice Reform, wrote in to say efforts to punish mentally disabled people who the state's own experts say were insane and therefore not responsible for their actions is unethical and immoral. We should focus on holding ourselves accountable as a community and work to fix the shortcomings in our mental health system. Dave writes in to say many people don't know it, but some advocates for the mentally ill want to abolish the insanity defense. That's because it is used to incarcerate people for longer periods than they might be in prison. Crimes like hitchhiking on the interstate or stealing cigarettes can lead to months or years locked up in a psych hospital. And often people are forced into an insanity defense against their will by being found incompetent to stand trial by a psychiatrist. I'm going to read two more and then we can discuss some of this. Dr. David Ratu, a child psychiatrist and professor of psychiatry and pediatrics at UVM's Lerner College of Medicine, wrote in with two questions. One, if you think things are controversial now, what happens if we ever get to the point where someone's psychosis can be very rapidly and efficiently treated? This could mean that someone is deemed insane at the time of a very serious crime, is quickly treated to the point of no longer being an acute safety risk, and then goes directly back into the community if there are no criminal charges. Would the public consider justice being served in these cases? Right now, he writes, I think our system in some ways relies on the fact that psychosis is not quickly, quote, cured, so that these individuals remain in a secure facility for more extended periods of time. But this situation could change as the science improves. And two, what's the role of substance abuse in insanity defenses? While we are used to hearing that someone can still be held criminally responsible for acts committed while acutely intoxicated, things get a little murkier if the process is more insidious. If someone becomes psychotic from chronically using high-potency cannabis, as has been shown to occur, is that person responsible for their behavior? And then Kathy in East Montpelier says, one of the questions raised by the recent Burgoyne homicide trial was, is a person who's in the midst of a psychotic episode unable, by virtue of his illness, to distinguish right from wrong in all areas of life? Evidently, the jury that convicted that defendant concluded that the two are not mutually exclusive. I wonder what mental health experts think. So, Dr. Ravin, a lot there, too. But, you know, what do you want to pick apart there from what listeners are asking us?
Oh, my goodness. There are so many good questions in there. And I was taking notes rapidly. So one of the things that struck me from one of your first callers was the issue of minor charges. Mm-hmm. And people having insanity defenses, a successful insanity defense for minor charges. I think the examples were hitchhiking and stealing cigarettes. That's exceedingly rare. Usually when people mount an insanity defense, it's for a very significant event and or significant crime. So that's unusual. I think Dr. Ritu, I'd like to address his comment, which I think is very timely and not something that is just something that may happen in the future. He raised the issue of as our medicines and our treatments improve, what will happen when someone's psychosis resolves quickly if they have a successful insanity defense and then they're hospitalized and their psychosis resolves, and they no longer need inpatient treatment. This is a very real issue, and I see it less as justice being served. I think that that was one of the issues brought up, but more as an important issue about what are the factors that might put this individual at risk of being aggressive towards others, if that was the issue. And what might be protective, and having a thoughtful plan in place and a system of care to support that individual in the community and protect them and their community.
Thomas Powell, what are you thinking about?
I wanted to touch on the substance abuse question that came up because there's it's very common that substance abuse plays a large role in aggravating underlying mental illness. And it's not uncommon when somebody comes to prison, they may in detention during the first 6 months or so, they may very well be showing signs of detoxification and other aspects of long-term drug use or alcohol use that really does alter their mental state. And after a number of months, they start to look a little clearer and a little more they brighten up and they start to make better decisions. And the act of actually detaining them has been had a beneficial sobriety effect on them. When that happens, you suddenly see the emergence of somebody else who you didn't know the first day. It's quite interesting, and it usually coincides with the reduction in other psychiatric symptoms. So a person looks mentally healthier as they get more sober. They go up and down together. When that happens, it oftentimes leads to a much more rapid resolution of the case, and it's those cases where somebody who doesn't get mentally healthier, you see the legitimacy of that claim. I would agree that really there's a certain amount of mythology about how often not guilty by reason of insanity is brought forward as a defense and used in some sort of successful way. It's actually an exceedingly rare outcome in court to go to trial and have this kind of outcome, exceedingly. And the idea that people get picked up for hitchhiking or smoking a joint and somehow get, you know, bustled off to a 1984 type of a setting where somebody takes away all their liberties and jams them into a mental health system is just – not really that much of an issue.
Well, it's interesting to talk with both of you about this and to learn more, and I suppose, you know, more deeply as we leave this conversation, to continue considering what we think the criminal justice system is for, and these questions about rehabilitation versus, you know, revenge and vindication in some ways. So I appreciate you having this part of the conversation with us as we carry on those other conversations in our own hearts and communities. Thomas Powell is a forensic psychologist and founding partner of Vermont Forensic Assessment. Dr. Simcha Raven is the interim chief medical officer at the Brattleboro Retreat, a forensic psychiatrist, and serves on the faculty at the Yale School of Medicine Division of Law and Psychiatry. Thanks very much to both of you.
Thank you.